Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 25th, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is Jan Keeson. The session number is KEJ 2001-5, and the title of Jan's presentation is Excruciating History of Dentistry. Let's listen in.
Also, I started out as a side job where I've been writing scripts for our public radios. We have a national public radio station at Augustana College. And I've been writing scripts on the history of words. So that's, you think, what in the world would you do about that? And it took me a couple years to figure out precisely that. And I'm still trying to figure it out. But it took me at least a couple years to even develop a library to do this. But the gist is to talk about the history of a word and inform and hopefully entertain, you know, an audience like VIK. Also, since there were people who heard these and wanted to hear them again or read them, that they are now in newspaper columns. And that was another bout. It took another bout of writing because I found out that it's very different to write for radio as opposed to write for an audience. They can read and refer back to things. And also just the rhythm of the words or turn of a phrase. There are some words that you could say easier over a radio than, and some words work better in print. So that was a hard thing to figure out, you know, what audience to write for. But since then, I can tell you just quickly, these are some of the samples of these scripts. Some of them are eponyms, or other ways, words that came from somebody else's name, like graham cracker, or guppy, or guillotine. And other words that I've written on are odd words like horse feathers, eavesdropper, nightmare, hush puppy, tooth bumper, malapropisms, those words. And then there are words that I've written about, for instance, in popular culture, ice cream, food, there's such a thing as gastroporn, and powdered water, and zip code wine. Nursery stories, they are so nasty. What do you think Seesaw Marjorie Daw is doing? It's just amazing that we read these things to our children. Mud walking is a sport. There are new words that's in our language called fuzzy elevator or frankenfood or bildering. There was a thief in New York who, like contrary to what we do out here rock climbing, decided to climb buildings and rob houses or apartments. You think you're in a high rise and nobody, and you're safe and nobody can get in there, but this guy actually was a builder. He'd climb up the side of buildings and rob people. So I wrote about builders. And then we have words that a lot of times you hear about in terms of whether they're bigoted words, like the word niggered. There was a fellow in New York was fired in a city council meeting for using that word. Well, actually, it comes from a very different root word than the word negro. So I write about that. Numbers, 13. Why can't you get an airline seat with number 13 on it, or a park with number 13? What's with this? And take the fifth. And then there's another thing in color. So anyway, I can read some. I told you that I would read The Excruciating History of Dentistry, so I'll show you how this works. Does going to the dentist make you jumpy? Just be glad you don't have to go to a tooth jumper. Before we had dentists and comfortable recliners, a tooth jumper would grip your head between his knees and bang away at your tooth with a hammer until your tooth dropped out. And before that, there were tooth fairies, there were people who believed in tooth worms. A tooth worm would bore into your tooth, supposedly, and cause a toothache, which people treated with frankincense and myrrh. So when the wise men brought those gifts to Jesus, maybe they were trying to get him a good start on dental hygiene. James Winbrandt, in The Excruciating History of Dentistry, tells us that some toothworm dentists would fumigate a patient's mouth with poisonous gas. Others took out mortar and pestle, ground herbs and mice heads into toothpaste. Others, who wanted to make sure their diagnosis was correct, actually hid a little white worm in a secret chamber of their dental pliers. When, with plenty of pomp, they diagnosed tooth worm and tap your throbbing tooth with their pliers until, presto, there would be your tooth worm dangling from the intrepid pincers. If that didn't help, you could always look for a tooth drawer, one who would draw out your tooth. The Dutch and Germans called them quacks. The Italians called them chiarlantos, or charlatans. But the English called the most flamboyant tooth drawers mountebanks. A mountebank pulled your tooth while mounted on a horse. They were the forerunners of American cowboy dentists who would lasso your tooth, wrap the other end of the string around the saddle, and gallop away. That also might explain why the Lone Ranger wore a mask. He was probably a well-known mountebank who was partial to teeth with silver fillings. Hi-ho, silver. Where else do you suppose he got all the silver for his silver bolts? The trick is to get out of these things once you've written them. How are you going to end them? So anyway, let me show you. Some of them are funny. This really did happen. This is called Ever Try Some Gestapo Soup. On one sweltering summer day, I stopped for lunch in Princeton, Illinois. A young waitress asked me if I would like to try some Gestapo soup. When she described it as a spicy Spanish soup made with lots of vegetables and told me that it was served cold, I realized that she had mistaken Gestapo for gazpacho, and she had created a wonderful malapropism. The word malapropism comes from the French words malappropriate, because, or meaning bad for the purpose, or not appropriate. The word was invented in 1775 by Richard Sheridan, a playwright who created a character called Mrs. Malaprop. Mrs. Malaprop confused similar sounding words with hilarious results. For instance, she referred to contagious countries, contagious countries when she meant contiguous. She urged someone to illiterate him from your mind when she meant obliterate. And she referred to superstitious articles when she meant suspicious. Shakespeare's clowns used malapropisms. So did Archie Bunker, Dan Quayle, and Mayor Daly predicted we shall reach greater and greater platitudes of achievement when he meant plateaus. Bella Abzug addressed a rally for the ERA and said, we need laws that protect everyone, men and women, straights and gays, regardless of sexual perversion, when she meant persuasion. And one of my students proudly told me that her car was environmentally friendly because it came with a Catholic converter. I suppose it ran on holy water. Some of them, okay. Sometimes I write in colors. So, red. The color red is bold and brilliant. It's the color of cataclysms, of marauding forest fires, erupting volcanoes, and midnight rivers of moving lava. It's the color of hell and of stunning sunsets. Red's that cardinal color of flash and feather. It's what makes cranberries saucy and what puts the velvet touch on an American beauty rose. Alexander Thoreau, in his book, The Primary Colors, tells us that red is the color of old theater seats, apocalyptic dragons, cheap whiskey, boxing gloves, hot anvils, Virginia creepers, strawberry blondes, and labels on old opera records. Red symbolizes east for the Chippewa, west for the Tibetan, and the color of God for the Hebrew. In China, red is the color of happiness. At one time, a Chinese bride would wear a red wedding gown with a red silk veil and ride to her wedding in a red sedan chair. Red letter days, at first, were religious holidays circled in red on the calendar. But folks who celebrate too much might wind up in the red. Accountants used to record deficits in red ink. And if your account stayed in the red, you weren't worth a red cent. If you wanted to elude hounding creditors, you might toss out a red herring or something really rank to divert their attention. Real herrings cured by smoke would turn reddish and odorous. Dog trainers used them to teach hounds how to follow a scent. But later, some clever criminal stole the idea and confused bloodhounds by dragging a red herring across their trail. Maybe it was their way of escaping all the red tape, a phrase that originated when British barristers tied up legal documents with red ribbons. Red is also associated with adultery. In A Scarlet Letter, Hester Prynne is forced to wear the letter A as a punishment for adultery. Most letter A's of that ilk were austere, stark, and disgraceful. But Hester, who understood both art and irony, embroidered a bold, brilliant, stunningly beautiful letter A. The limbs alone were 3 1/4 inches long. Even more outlandish, she embellished the letter lavishly with sumptuous gold thread. But she chose a red background because, although red might be shameful, it is also the color of love. All right. Do you ever wonder, some of these histories are just so sad. I'll talk a little bit about some of the elements of women's history, just two of them. I'm not much of a feminist, but I fell into some of these things that just absolutely fascinating. Womb with a View. And I attended a seminar at the University of Chicago not so long ago. I graduated from there, and they have Chicago Alumni Days, and one of the profs there was talking about classical history, the history of hysterectomies and such. And I thought maybe I can get a word out of that. So I attended it. And this is what I learned. The old English word womb, you can see when we're recording these things in the radio, you know, we have breaks. I usually read them ahead a few times to myself. But there's an engineer in the back, and Don Wooten is there as a station manager. And so when we make mistakes, all these things that you hear on the air, you think, oh, that's just so spontaneous. But what happens is they stop and start again. So you hear people reading in a far more pleasant way than what you have to do like right here. So it's all attitude. But anyway, the old English word wam for belly gave birth to womb. And for centuries, wombs caused women plenty of trouble. The trouble started when people imagined that a womb could wander around a woman's body. A womb would become frustrated and wayward if it was fruitless and failed to bear children. So it wandered willfully, venting its anger. It had teeth and could gnaw into your heart. It could paw at your liver and pounce on your stomach. It could poke around and sniff out attractive odors. Apothecaries tried to lure it back into its proper place by packing a woman with aromatic herbs such as laurel, rose, mint, and marjoram as far as a feather quill could push, which must have created quite a ticklish situation. To drive it away from the upper body, medics coated women's nostrils with seal oil and made them swallow ripe cabbage juice. You might wonder why the ancients thought wombs could be so willful, but consider what they must have watched. A powerful muscle that contracts when it wants to, one that wakes to its own rhythm, one that pushes life upon us, or bleeds new mothers to death. Hippocrates believed that when a womb wandered into the chest cavity, it could cause hysterical suffocation. So women who were short of breath were thought to suffer from hysteria, a word brought forth from the Greek hustera for womb. Some hysterics would laugh uncomfortably or panic beyond reason. Doctors decided that their wounds were possessed by demons. So for centuries, they prescribed amulets for women to ward off demons that like to crawl up and settle inside. Pity the poor demon that was barred from a woman's womb, especially since wombs were so powerfully attractive. For the womb was a passion pit with an appetite. It was so determined to get with child that willy-nilly it beckoned its partner, the generative organ in man. It's interesting that Plato also regarded the male member as disobedient, headstrong, and frantic with passion. Maybe so. But if a womb was supposed to have teeth, what do you suppose happened next? So that's about as bawdy as we get on the air. All right, here's the other one about women's history that will just break your heart. It's called Gilding the Lily, the artwork of foot-bound women. For well over 1,000 years, the Chinese pursued an aesthetic ideal known as San Jun Jin Mian, meaning the 3-inch golden lily or golden lotus. Because of this ideal, millions of Chinese women endured the excruciating pain of foot binding. A perfectly bound foot must be shaped like the bud of a lotus flower, full and rounded at the heel and coming to a thin point at the front. And how is this achieved? Break her arch and bind all her toes except the big toe beneath her foot. Different Chinese dynasties offer different stories in how such an ideal for a perfect 3-inch sized female foot originated. One compelling story, one theory suggests it began in the 10th century when palace dancers wrapped their feet in the shape of a lotus bud. At that time, the compression was only slight, but the tiny fragile foot aroused lust and pity. So the custom caught on. And through the years, the bindings got tighter. Soon the Chinese word for lotus came to mean tiny foot. Moreover, the word was euphonious because phonetically it made an agreeable sound, agreeably erotic. Men longed to fondle the tiny foot, to pet and kiss it, to put it into their mouths. And the crevice in the delicate, tortured foot offered a channel for wildly erotic stimulation. A foot-bound woman not only seemed sensual, but also safe. She couldn't walk far from the bedroom. And when she walked, she swayed with muscular tension that theoretically developed voluptuous buttocks and tightened her genitals. Besides that, little feet were light in bed. Not like big feet, they could turn around under the covers and cause an annoying draft. Moreover, little feet were economical. You only needed scraps of fabric for shoes. And as economist Thorsten Veblen points out, they were a token of conspicuous consumption. A foot-bound woman was a richly kept woman who didn't have to use her feet to work. So foot-bound women sat, and they spent much of their time embroidering stunningly beautiful slippers for their mutilated feet. Often they would overlay their slipper fabric with gold or silver covered thread, fastening it down with tiny stitches. The English word for that is called couching, from the French couturière, to lie down or to overlay with stitches. Another English expression applies here too, gilding the lily. Westerners get it from Shakespeare's King John, where a second coronation was considered to gild refined gold or to paint the lily. So this word actually comes from two different origins. But in the East, when foot-bound Chinese women embroidered golden threads into slippers for their golden lilies, they were also gilding the lily. But I just find that history stunning. And for the library, it would be so good for you to get this. There's a book there that is published by, the author is Jackson, it's called Splendid Slippers, but it's a picture book full of these slippers that these women embroidered, and they are just stunningly gorgeous. They're artworks, and there are actually people who collect these things now. But it's such a sad history to think for centuries that women had these feet, and this book tells about this. It's really horrible. But what they, and you think that they would do it with like a little baby that age, imagine binding their feet, but what they would do is they would wait till they were about six, and then they would crack this little child's foot, and the foot binder would come in there, and gradually they would tighten the bandages. And also, those foot would, there would, they would, the skin would decay there too. I mean, it was just a mess. But it's amazing that tradition carried on for so many centuries.
Do they still practice it in places in China?
I hope not. From what I've heard from that book anyway, that is declining. But there are still women alive today. Yeah. You can see x-rays of their feet. You can see just the skeletal turn of their muscles.
So they just had to carry them around in the car?
Well,
they could usually walk.
They were supposed
to have like peg legs.
Pardon?
They'd be walking like on peg legs.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And for the guys there, that was a real sensual attraction to see them walk like that. And, you know, they were kept safe and at home, and they were supposed to be sexy, and that tradition.
Do you think that Chinese women today have smaller feet because of doing that? Did that modify any genetic...
That's an excellent question. I can't answer that.
Material.
I don't know. But that would make an interesting study. Yeah.
As I understood, it wasn't all girls. It was certain castes, I think.
Well, you know, that makes sense, Whitey, because, you know, if you wanted a woman to work in the farm or in the field, you wouldn't bind her feet. So I'm sure it had to do with some class.
I think it's almost over with. I read an article about a year ago, and I don't remember every bit of it, but I think it's pretty much a dead one now.
Yeah.
If it isn't, there aren't very many people that do it.
Well, I don't know.
That'd be horrible torture, that's what it was.
Yeah. But anyway, the history of words really tells you about the history of humanity. You know, how things... see other ones that I can talk to you about. Maybe we want something that's funnier. Oh, graham crackers. That's kind of a funny one. All right, this is a euphemism of Reverend Graham. This guy, I think he graduated from Yale, if I remember right. I wrote this a long time ago. Anyway, all of us have heard of decadent desserts. Quite often, they contain something rich with the graham cracker crust. But if Sylvester Graham knew how his graham crackers had been corrupted, he would rise from his grave and admonish all of us for our sinful eating habits. Graham graduated from Amherst, and by 1830 had gained a certain notoriety as a Bible thumper who warned against wicked eating. He admonished his Presbyterian congregation to eat food the way God intended it, untouched by salt and pepper, which he claimed would cause insanity. After Graham sniffed out the sin and seasonings, he got a whiff of the wickedness in whiskey. He warned that liquor would arouse the evils of sexual appetite, and if you drank wine and ate a steak marbled with fat, you could send your libido to Freud and back. But since at that time there were plenty of temperance advocates to go around, Graham focused most on his crusade to urge people not to eat another harmful food, white bread. Graham warned that white bread robbed Christians of the whole grains God created for their better health. So despite his wacky theology, Graham at least had the foresight to advocate what many nutritionists are telling us today. Cut down on salt and alcohol and eat foods made from whole grains. With whole grains in mind, Graham introduced the Graham cracker. But since he was considered something of a crackpot, it is likely that the term graham cracker came from a pun on the slang word crackers, which meant someone who is insane or mad. And there is no doubt that Graham attracted more than his share of crackpots. In fact, his crusades often incited riots. Mobs gathered, and friends and foes of white breath waged battles across the flour bins. It makes you wonder what else Graham was putting into those crackers. But anyway, that's where that word came from. How many of you are left-handed here? Anybody? Any left-handers? No? How did we? Left-handed rights and right-handed majority. The word right has always been upheld by the majority. And since the majority is right-handed, right is dexterous, Latin for favorable, or on the right side. On the other hand, left is maladroit, the mal or evil opposite of adroit, French for right. So there's a real stigma here. And what's French? What's the French word for left? Gauche. Lefties lack grace and tact. Left is socially awkward or gawky from gawk handle, meaning left-handed. Even today, left-handed compliments are clumsy and lack sincerity. And left-handed acts are ill-conceived. They show poor judgment. Worse yet, in Latin, left is sinister, evil, and ominous. In the Bible, when Jesus separates the sheep from the goats, he sends the goats to the left, to eternal damnation. But the upright sheep are sent to the right to enjoy their salvation. After all, right conforms to justice and morality. Right is correct. It arises out of fact and reason. People who tell the truth are forthright. Right is timely. The right time. Right is clockwise, but left is counterclockwise. We try to put things right, to get in the right state of mind, the right physical condition. We know our rights. Blacks who were refused rights finally got righteous or militant. Right is intensive. It's right away. It keeps right on going. Right is fitting, proper, like the right dress, the right girl, or the right whale. One with the right resources of oil and blubber. One that is easier to capture than the more aggressive sperm whale. A sperm whale was probably a leftist in whale politics, a dangerous reactionary, the kind that attracted Ahab, a captain who wasn't right. Right is conservative. In most European legislatures, conservatives were seated to the right like honored guests. Typically, they were the most distinguished dominant members of parliament, and they came from the right. But dissenters were seated to the left, or in the left wing. They were kept in left field, a position far from center. Speedily, or right off the bat, they were left out and forced to field leftover legislation. Given their history of troublemaking, you wonder if leftists actually get up on the wrong side of the bed, the left side. Or maybe it's just that by now, leftists have gotten really tired of the right, of the high-handed, right-handed majority. Anyway, there's that one. Anybody, I should maybe ask you if you have any questions, you know, if you have any words or phrases or anything that puzzle you. And not the expert, but maybe I can answer some of them. Yeah, or you could give me ideas of what to write on.
The article, the first one, the first one you read about people that are used, change words just slightly. I'm not sure. I mean, I know I do that for emphasis to see if people are listening to me or not. Just enough so they get alert and say, whoa, what did that person say? Or sometimes for absolute joke, you know, to be really funny. So I'm wondering, is that what you had in mind when you wrote that or what?
What, was it right-handed?
No. Similar words that they deliberately, I don't know about deliberately, but they misused or mispronounced.
Melophobia.
That they do that on purpose, no. Pardon?
With an M, the term?
Melophobia.
Malapropisms?
Yeah.
Because I suffer from that a lot, and my dad did. He was always mispronouncing words and stuff like that, and family members and friends just tease him, and then I kind of do the same. I do the same thing. I can see the word. You know, I get the first part of it. Okay, there's an S.
Yep.
Like synchronize. Okay, it's a long word. S, and there's a C in there, and I think it's C. Okay, and I came out with, okay, everybody, let's Simonize our watches. You know?
Well, that's a good example.
Not having an idea of how to truly pronounce it, but or a time I wanted back in New York, I wanted a rectangle type of pizza, which is called a Sicilian. And I wanted to be so sure I pronounced it correctly. And I was with some college girlfriends, and we were at a wonderful place that makes it. And I asked for a Sicilian slice of pie. And they just about dropped, and everybody was shocked. And it's like, I'm oblivious to the mispronunciation until I, well, then how do you say it? You know? Sicilian!
I think
it was Ness, and that's a long word.
And that makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
It makes sense to me, but it's really, so I kind of stay away from long words. And if I can never put it in the proper content of the sentence, that's another thing that I just get talking and it kind of slips out, so I don't try to impress people with my vocabulary, because it's always going to be mispronounced somehow. Or inappropriate.
It sounds to me that you're fairly articulate. I think we all make those mistakes. If it's any comfort to you, not so long ago I was talking about the Civil War to my students who were madly taking notes, and talking about General Sherman just raising everything, you know, through Georgia. And I said Sherman came through with his tanks. During the Civil War, right?
Yeah,
sure. And we all wrote it down. You know, nobody asked me. And it didn't hit me until after class, so, you know.
Nobody said water tank or anything, huh?
I was thinking of a Sherman tank, you know, General Sherman, you know. But I think we all do those things. And, you know, some people are luckier than others that they don't do them in public. But, you know, look at Dan Quayle. You remember all the things he would say wrong. And I'm pretty sure George Bush is not too far behind. And those of us who are not, you know, real happy with George Bush grin at this, you know. I want to put a sign on my back. I voted for Ralph Nader. But any other words that you're interested in or that you hear that you're puzzled about? Raining cats and dogs, curry favor.
Tell me about that.
Okay, that came, there's a couple theories about that. Raining cats and dogs came from probably poor gutter systems where there would be a sudden flood and the little animals in the area would be drowned and they would kind of wash away and they'd say it's raining cats and dogs. There are other theories on that, but that seems like the best one. Curry favor, that comes from a medieval story about some mythical figure who was the clown. It was actually written in the 1700s as a satire to the French government. There was Favol was this clownish character, and you had to be really obsequious. You had to just really try and curry his favor or become. People would do some of the more outrageous things just to gain his favor. It was a satire on politics and how that worked. But I mean, ivory soap. I could tell you a little bit of the word ivory from the Egyptian Eber brings to mind scrimshaw, Chinese fans, dice, billiard balls, piano keys, and poachers. Ironically, live ivory comes from freshly butchered African elephants. Dead ivory is dug from beneath the tundra where you can mine the teeth and tusks of hairy mammoths and mastodons. The poorest ivory comes from a hippopotamus, a walrus, or a narwhal. Wildly impractical ivory comes from an ivory tower. the lofty retreat of some preoccupied intellectuals. That expression rose in 1837 when Charles Augustin Saint-Beuve wrote a poem comparing a poet's residence to an ivory tower. Maybe it was his ivory eyrie. About 40 years later, the poet could have taken a bath up there in ivory soap. Ivory soap got its name from the Bible. In 1878, Harley Proctor was looking for a better name for his white soap when he heard his minister read from the 45th Psalm, "Your robes are all fragrant with myrrh and aloes and cassia. From ivory palaces, stringed instruments made you glad." What better biblical mandate could there be for a Christian capitalist than to manufacture cakes and flakes of ivory soap? After all, it was 99.44% pure. Proctor introduced that expression when he reversed the negatives in the chemist's report that ivory soap contained impurities of 56.00%. Therefore, Proctor claimed positively that ivory soap was 99.44% pure. So pure it floated. Ironically, such a pure soap floated because of human frailty. Just before his lunch hour, a factory worker forgot to turn off the switch for the main mix master in the soap vats. When he returned, he realized that too much air had been whipped into the soap batter. He didn't want to waste it, so he poured it into molds anyway, and when it was retailed, grimy people were delighted to see that it bobbed the surface of their rookie bathwater. Ivory soap debuted in October of 1879, the same month Thomas Edison successfully tested his incandescent light bulb, an invention that commanded enough candle power to snuff out another of Proctor's businesses, making candles. Consequently, he floated his capital on ivory, and that's how Harley Proctor cleaned up on soap.
None of these changes, the history of words, really have to do with grammar, do they?
Oh, they probably do. Can you give me a specific example?
Well, that we're using nouns as verbs or the other way around, things like that.
I can't think of an example of that now. I can't.
You know how does the English language stack up in idiomatic expressions compared to other languages? Do you know anything about that?
Oh, Jeff, I don't know that either. What I would like to
do... We do have a lot.
Pardon?
We do have an awful lot.
We have a lot, and I don't know what the idioms are. I know when I went to Canada not so long ago, they were talking about fish cops. I don't know if that's quite an idiom, but what do you mean by fish cops? And they actually were the game wardens. And they were talking about cougars in this particular instance, but they had to watch out for the fish cops because if they shot a cougar when they saw it on their property, the fish cops would come by. What I would like to do with sabbatical the next time, which would be about 4 years, is go to New Zealand and see once, they do speak in English, and see once if there are any expressions that are native to that country, and Australia too.
I know in Spanish, in a different country in South America, they have different expressions in other countries. I mean, they're all Spanish,
yeah.
But they don't understand because they're idiomatic.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, they have some that are, that you could translate them in our language, you kind of understand, but we just don't use them. For instance, they have a woman who's pregnant is lista para la foto, ready for the photo,
Why would that be? What's the story behind that?
Ready for the photo? For a photo to take a picture of her or something, I don't know.
That would be interesting.
An interesting one, if a couple asks another person to go with them someplace, so there's thread, he'll say, no gracias, no quiero tocar el violín. It means, no thank you, I don't want to play the violin. It's the third person,
Interesting. Well, any of us who've studied a foreign language, they do usually give you a list of idioms, don't they? Mm-hmm. And if you're traveling, the travel books a lot of times will give you a list of
idioms. But, you know, they change, too, you know. I've seen some of them, I haven't been South American in 25 years, but I've seen lists of them now that I don't have a clue what they mean because they're idiomatic, you know. They don't...
Yeah.
The literal meaning, the meaning isn't the literal meaning.
Yeah.
I have some equipment. The only place that can get parts is in Australia, and that's quite interesting, really. It's one word they use so common. I mean, you get over it, and within a month you're using it too. I can't. It's a slang term. Oh, I know. Heads off right now. But you see, they're a dollar. It's a dollar, but it's only worth half of ours. And so you've got to convert and stuff. There's a lot of talking in it, and sometimes you've got to ask them over again. It's different, but it's kind of fun.
Yeah, it's, you know, but those histories tell us a lot about their culture. I mean, what do they think about a pregnant woman ready for a photo? You know, I had five kids, and when I was pregnant, that was always something we wanted to kind of cover up. Now they're wearing maternity clothes. It, you know, it makes it very obvious that women are pregnant. But what are the Spanish? I mean, opportunity, photo opportunity? I would love to know the answer to that. Pardon?
It's ready to come out, ready to show.
That seems like a real likely prospect.
Well, I have enough trouble with my husband's from the Midwest and getting used to his, the slang, whatever, the terms that they come out with.
Yeah.
For their area, it's like, what? You know, well, hell for stout, built something's built. We built a deck onto our house in the earthquake area, and the building inspector came around, and we must have the second permit in all of King County. Most people just put up the deck and stuff, but we got a permit for it. And anyway, the inspector used the same term my husband had used before. It's built hell for stout, and he has another one called colder than a brass bra, or than a well digger's crack, or something. Just like, what are you talking about? You know.
But you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because that is changing in our language, a lot of those things, because now we have CNN, it's just more people are watching, you know, we're just more united, so we're losing sight of those localisms, and there are some people that are worried about the same kind of people who are trying to record languages that we're losing, or dialects. But for a literature teacher, I find this fascinating, because that's what makes local or regional lit. And there's a big argument in my discipline now as to, you know, whether there is such a thing as local or regional dialect. And I think there still is. But a lot of that is eroding because of mass communication and this word globalization. If I hear that one more time, I'm going to open an artery. But we have these generic terms for so many things now. In Huck Finn, somebody made a pretty compelling argument that there's at least 9 different dialects in here. And then there's another person that made an argument, you know, he's Huck Black, saying that, and that was not a compelling argument, but it got a lot of press. I don't know if you ran across that in the library or not, but it was Huck Black. And, but anyway, those regionalisms or those dialects, horse feathers is an example of that. In Vermont, that meant for some reason shingles that were placed that were kind of dovetailed right under. Why they thought they looked like horse feathers, I don't know.
They're roof shingles?
Yeah.
When you were talking about left and right in Canada and in England, maybe a lot of the countries that were in the Dominion of the Great Dominion, but anyway, they, instead of saying lieutenant, as we do in the United States, they call them lieutenants.
Hmm.
And I don't know if that
it's
has to do
spelled
with...
like lieutenant.
Yes, it is. So, and I wonder if it has to do with left and right.
We have asphalt instead of asphalt.
and we have.
Yeah. Where does that come from?
It's a localism, just what you were talking about, I'm sure, but people just, you know, I live in the country in a log cabin, and the two country towns on either side of where I live are pronounced this way, Viola and Milan.
Viola and?
And Milan. And, you know, we always think of Viola and Milan. But why they, you know, why they did that.
Was there ever a time where the U.S. had decided to change all the spelling of words? Like, we keep an Oxford spelling in Canada, whereas you've switched to your own, you've dropped all the O-U's and just have O-R.
Much more phonetic.
Much more phonetic.
Well, there's a lot of different dictionaries. And we do have supposedly certain grammatical standards, but the idioms, by now, at least the way I teach writing, is I'm much more concerned about logic and argument than I am about some of these, you know, whether a word is spelled with an O-R or U-R ending, you know, I don't really care that much about that. And some people just take this much more seriously. But I think that we have standards now that are increasingly flexible because we have so many different cultures who are, you know, in this mix of what's America. And I think we try to be sensitive to that. But the French, if you think about standards, the French actually have a commission that decides what words can be officially allowed in their vocabulary, and they're just practically militant about this. So they have very strong feelings and very strict standards as to what can be grammatical, what spelling, and we're much more flexible. I mean, what I can see varies from dictionary to dictionary. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it reflects, you know, local traditions or, you know, broader vision.
I was going to say, I hate to ask anybody to go fishing with me because there's over 30 different names for the word angleworm or red Georgia red wiggler or on and on. I don't even remember more than a couple of them. But 30 names for angleworm that are localisms in the United States.
Interesting.
Over 30 of
them. Well, I have a rancher friend who has a pretty good sized ranch in northeastern Wyoming, right up to Devil's Tower, right outside of the Black Hills there. And he has this rich metaphor, wonderful language. I don't think he graduated from eighth grade, but I love listening to him talk because he talks so much. He's a coming and a going, and you know, and he's a very bright man, but speaks in a lingo that's quite different than ours. And I just find that fascinating. I used to know, and one time I can remember just the metaphors that this old trapper that I met years ago in Upper Michigan used. He said, that person has no more Christianity than my hound dog chasing a rabbit. And I thought, that is a good metaphor. But you come, and language is just fascinating the more you take a look at it.
Is there anything that disturbs you or aggravates you about grammar? Or do you feel we're so flexible that anything goes?
No. What irritates me now is when my students talk about Ishmael and Queequeg bonding, or that Ahab is in denial. To use these, you know, these generic psychological terms on things, I find that irritating. But I like to get them to think originally. But they're into this jargon now. Jargon just irritates the hell out of me. I mean, my own discipline is by far the most guilty of it. And if you want to hear me on that, I'll tell you. It seems now that we have two different kinds of people teaching literature. You have people who try to let the primary text come alive and hopefully let that take precedent. And whatever theory or whatever you say is couched in how well you can understand it, and letting the author, the master writer, speak. And then you have another group of people who write terribly, speak in jargon, and preface that over, say, something like Huck Finn or Moby Dick or any of the great works of fiction, and they talk about it in terms of theory or writing. And then if you read this stuff, you can't read what they say. And it just irritates me to no end. That makes me more angry than anything. And we've moved far away from the artfulness. What makes fine art? What's beautiful? What do you love? When I talked about McQueen the other day, he used the word beautiful. And a lot of times you might think that that's overused, but the way he says that and the language he used is just so beautiful. And we talked about that. And you know, just to show you how serious this is, I've got a young kid here, a lanky guy who's at Stanford. He's about to graduate. You know, he's an undergrad. He's working he's going back to Stanford in a couple weeks. And he loves literature and he loves writing. And he said to me, you know, he says, I just love what you said. I love Norman McLean, and I always have, and I'd forgotten this until you brought this up. And he said, when you read some of those passages in literature, you made me realize why I took up studying literature. But he said, I don't really dare go to my prof now because I don't want him to think, if I said I want to write my senior thesis on Norman McLean, I don't want him to think that I'm writing in something like Michael Crichton or, you know, one of the lower class mystery writers. And what he was saying is this important enough for my prof at Stanford to take seriously so he will work with me on this thesis? That's what he was asking. And it's sad because we have lost, I mean, you know, is there any theory? And this is a kid who also loves James Joyce. And we talked a bit about that, but what makes great literature? We've lost sight of that. This is kind of off the topic, but I just have a passion about this, so I have to tell you. Paul Olson was here. I just missed him. He's one of my best buddies at Augustana College. But he and I were talking one day about what was the best book we ever read. And he said, well, it has to be Sophie's Choice. And I love Paul. But I thought to myself, it can't be Sophie's Choice. I can carry that in his class, but that is not the best book they've ever. And he said, well, what do you think? I said, well, it's got to be Moby Dick, you know. Now I'm disagreeing what the best book is, by the way. And I'm pretty sure he thought the same thing to me. But anyway, we decided we were going to debate this in public. And Paul is a very charismatic, the students just love him, and rightfully so. And, but I felt strongly enough about it, I thought, okay, we'll debate. Well, then pretty soon, one of my other buddies, I live this charmed existence at Augustana College. People have been very kind to me there, and I have this mentor who's now retired, his name is Roel Tweet. And when he heard we were going to do it, he wanted to be in on it too. And his favorite book really is Moby Dick, but he, because he's so kind, he let me do this, and he said, well, I'll talk about Uncle Tom's Cabin. So anyway, the three of us had this class that we taught at 8 in the morning about the best book we ever read, and arguing. So we needed to establish some criteria. What was the best book that was ever written? And meanwhile, since I was going to argue with Paul, I took Sophie home. And I hadn't read that since I was in high school. And I picked it up, and I was just blown away by the beauty of that book. And the prose and the language, the description, it has all the characteristics of a great book. So not only was I blown away by this, but I thought, why aren't we teaching this? Why is Paul such a maverick here? I mean, nobody teaches Sophie in all the canon of American literature. You just don't hear it. You know, you've heard of William Styron, but unless it's in Virginia or the South, you will not see any of William Styron's work in any of the main colleges in the country.
Paul's done something on Sophie's Choice.
Yes, he has. Yeah. So anyway, I know exactly what he said to you. But because that arose out of what we were doing, and then we had a gig at the library this past year, and he talked about, you know, what makes a great book. The title of our gig at the library was All the Books the Critics Love to Hate. And so we have this, it's a series of free lectures at the Rock Island Library in the college. You know, I'm in charge of that, and I ask the profs every year to participate in it. And it's a big crowd drawer. The library gets lots and lots of people in there during that time. But anyway, he gave that talk, and
Oh, people just loved it. But anyway, the next thing, I thought, why isn't this in our canon of American Lit? And so, because I knew it was great literature. So I asked one of my former profs at Chicago, who anthologizes American literature, James E. Miller Jr. And I said, you know, what happened here? Why don't you teach Styron? And he says, you're right, you should. But we talked about what the answer is, and it has a lot to do with politics. Sophie isn't Jewish. She's Polish, and she goes through the Holocaust. And there are a whole group of critics, big names, Cynthia Ozick, who really object to this. And they say that Styron has done a terrible disservice to the Jewish people, and we own the Holocaust. So anyway, he and Paul got kind of a pissing match in one of the major literary magazines in the country over this. And I have that in my office if you're interested. But anyway, Paul's argument was that Styron was talking about the nature of evil and that this is universal. And it wasn't insensitive for him to depict it that way. But anyway, the issue was, what were the great books? So we set up some standards for that. What we thought, and we tested it, and it just got to be really cool because, you know, when I started out, I had like three of them. First of all, it's something that fires your soul. It's that you've got to read this book feeling. So that's the first criteria. The second is it's something beautiful, you know, in terms of language or precision of diction. Very much like beauty in art or in music, you know, something that's lyrical to your ear. But anyway, it's got to have beauty to it. And it doesn't necessarily mean that what's beautiful is easy to read. You know, somebody brought up Lolita. Not exactly the best book to read nowadays, but it's beautifully written, so that there is beauty to it. The third criteria we had was, let's see, Swanee, our former pastor, gave us this one. He says, you've got to have something of ethical significance. And Tweet and Paul right away, you know, said, yeah, that has to be a criteria too. So that was their third one. And then when Styron came to our campus, and that's a whole other one, wonderful story, thanks to Paul Olson. But when he came, he said, you've got to have a central character who comes alive. That's got to be one of the criteria for a great book. So we put that one in there. And finally, it's got to be something you want to return to. Because, you know, we read page turners, and, you know, I love mysteries or whatever else, but I don't want to read them again. You know, once I've read them is enough. But every time I read Sophie or Moby Dick or Brothers Karamazov or any of the really great books, there's something there I haven't seen before. It's just like folks here listening to a Beethoven symphony, or I've heard that somebody played Puccini on a clarinet, they're still talking about it. It was, why was it? Because the music, just it's something you want to hear again. It's just so beautiful, you could just weep over it. You can hardly stand it. It's like being here. So, I mean, there's such beauty here too, but it happens in art and literature. But anyway, we lost sight of that in our discipline. And I'm really concerned about it. I think Paul is, but what we try to do and what I tried to do with the young guy is to say, you have to follow your heart. You've got to do your homework and, you know, really know what you're talking about. But don't write a paper to please a prof. Because, you know, they're fallible. I mean, they're not like the great authors. You have to do something that you have fire and passion for, and you have to do your homework to be able to argue why this happens. What rhetorical devices does Norman MacLean use to make this art form? And he says, well, Aristotle has this theory in it. I said, yeah, but what do you see? And then take a look at what Aristotle says. So, but the kids now are so intimidated, and it sounds so much more important to cite all this charity. So you got me on the war path for that.
Do you find that there's a decline in reading among college?
Yeah, well, why wouldn't there be if that's what's going on? But yeah, a lot of kids
There's so many other distractions.
Right.
Electronic things.
And you know, that was just what's so life-affirming about this place. That is not happening here. The kids that are here are reading.
Yeah,
and you don't see that in other communities.
Especially when it rains.
Well, they just, it's just, it's part of their lives, you can see that. Part of going to bed at night. And I think a generation like this is far more inclined to understand any of the arts than kids who play video games. I mean, it doesn't take a whole stretch of imagination to figure that out.
I've got relatives that might have 6 books in their house, you know. I mean, they just don't read, you know. I mean, they're not illiterate, right? I mean, I have a good friend of mine who's got a master's degree, and he said he hasn't read anything since high school.
Well, even our, the bad news is, folks, even the college kids aren't reading like we should. I mean, one of the students, and because of that, particularly in pledging time, they don't read like they should, so I tend to give them more quizzes, just on details. And one of the kids said to me in defense last spring, and I read this book, she said, as if that was unusual. So, yeah.
You didn't use Cliff Notes, huh?
Well, I have Cliff Notes. I know what's in those things. but, yeah, there's a generation that kids think, they think it's, they don't read as much, and boy, I think that's so important for us. I mean, we all know this, but a lot of us don't act on it. And you have such a wonderful library for little kids up there. It just blew me away. But anyway, why don't I close? I can read you just one more thing about history, and then I'll close with something I saw you do in chapel the other day. Just black. There was a controversy in the newspaper, and we see increasingly people being concerned about racist terms. So, black is the color of night, the badge of hell, the dark shadow of dungeons and of Calcutta's black hole. It was the darkest, it has the darkest visual value on the achromatic scale. It reflects little light and has no predominant hue. But basic black can also be stylish and elegant, especially when it comes in limousines and black tie dinners. And black is sexy. Doesn't every prowling woman need a little black dress? And the most seductive nightgowns come in black. Black might be beautiful, but it's also associated with what is soiled, evil, depressing, mournful, angry, and censorious. So folks who promote black pride regard many black idioms as racist, like black is sin, black pit, and oh my black soul. They might seem racist today, but those terms developed long before European whites were aware of a black race. And they arose not out of racism, but religious beliefs that associated black with the dark underworld, with hell and the devil. When the plague or the Black Death came along, it was called black because it caused dark, deadly hemorrhages. Black sheep were undervalued because merchants demanded white wool so they could dye it whatever color they wanted. Black markets sold illegal goods underground or in dark areas where criminals of all colors hide. I could just stop here. Today, those are racist terms. And I think it's good that we're sensitive to these issues, but I think it's also good that we're educated enough to know where they came from, that there isn't some conspiracy against the black race in this particular instance that came up with these words. So that's one of the reasons I wrote this. Black widows are those venomous spider ladies whose bite makes some women widows. And most widows dress in black to show respect. That custom appeared long before the Dark Ages. In fact, anthropologists tell us that primitive whites dressed in black and even painted their bodies black to disguise themselves from spirits of the dead. Primitive blacks did just the opposite. And in the Mediterranean countries, a widow would wear veils and black clothing to hide her husband's predatory spirit, hide from her husband's predatory spirit. Henry VIII, who kept a black book, blacklisted monasteries during his power struggle with the Church of Rome so he could grab their land. Charles II blacklisted 58 persons who conspired to execute his father. Later, black books kept records of criminals, or women, if you will, bachelor. And black mail was first posted in the 19th century when the Danes executed a tribute or mala. White male was paid in silver, but black male was paid in muddy produce or livestock. By the 16th century, Scottish border chiefs who threatened to ravage farms and crops were blackmailing or extorting payments from peasants. Blackmail, blacklist, black sheep, black as sin, none of these terms began as racist, and they shouldn't be today. In fact, anybody who is saying so is telling a white lie. Let me close with what I saw in Vespers last night. They had, I'm sure some of you might have been there, huh, where they had people lighting candles and praying basically for each other. And I was struck by the tenderness. And there is a spirit here, I'm not churchgoer, and there is a spirit here that was really moving in terms of people who had this energy and they cared about things that matter a lot in life. And that really impressed me. And I thought that there was such tenderness. And so I'll go away thinking about that for a long time. But anyway, I wrote something on tender, and so I'd like to close with that. Tenders are caretakers, and they are tough. Try to get near a mother swan tending a nest of cygnets, or watch an eagle parent tend its young when the nest is crowded with the weakling. In Latin, tender means to hold. Today, it's a tough job. Tendons hold muscle to bone. Tenons hold our beliefs. Mortar and tenon hold the beams above us. A locomotive couldn't run without an iron tender that holds chunks of coal to fire its boilers. Tender comes at the business end of finance. To hold property, you put up legal tender. You tender a bid. And if you tend to renege on a contract, it's likely you will be forced to tender your resignation. If you want tender steak, you might have to get tough on the meat with a mallet, or if you can afford it, to buy a piece of tenderloin. The tenderloin is also a part of New York geography. In the 19th century, it referred to the district west of Broadway from 23rd to 42nd Streets, a tough district that offered tender rewards to police who ignored vice for some prime-cut bribes. A tendercomer is a newcomer who is forced to tough it out. Today, dudes with cowboy boots from Neiman Marcus get tender feet. But the word originally limped into the language behind the great cattle drives of the 19th century, when cattle were forced to walk from Texas to Montana. Cowboys who rode got saddle sores, but it was the cattle that wound up with tender feet. Perhaps tenderness matters most when you are greeted by a tough world. We prize hothouse orchids for their fragile beauty, but what is more starkly tender than a ditch lily growing alongside a gravel road? Or a tottering calf licked by its raspy-tongued mother? And for humans, despite our tough hold, who in this harsh world doesn't long to be taken up tenderly? All right, leave you with that.
Thank you.
You're a good audience. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
I tire you about literature.